The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Hello. I'm very excited again today for part two of my conversation with Francis Weller about his book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, in which he not only writes eloquently and just so honestly about grief, but he writes about rituals that he facilitates in which groups of people come together to grieve. So we're going to continue this conversation today. I hope you'll take some time to listen to part one of the interview, pulling both of them together. Francis Weller is a psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist who has been described as a jazz artist, improvising and moving fluidly in and out of deep emotional territories with groups and individuals, bringing imagination and attention to places often held with judgment and shame. He's currently completing his second book, A Trail on the Ground, Tracking the Ways of the Indigenous Soul. We ended our interview last week at the very start of our discussion of the five gates of grief he outlines in his book, Entering the Healing Ground. We'll begin today at gate one, which is called Everything We Love, We Will Lose. In part one of our interview last week, we spent some time talking about this concept because when we truly acknowledge that one day we will lose everything we love, we can be honest about the feelings that accompany that truth, which impacts how we live while we're here. Francis writes in his book, quote, "It is only when we deny grief's entry into our lives that we begin to compress the breadth of our emotional experience and live shallowly." This is for you, Francis, I'm wondering if you'd like to say anything in recap about what we said about this gate before we move into exploring illness as another grief that's within this gate.
I happily to do so. Good morning, Marianne. It's good to be back with you.
Thanks.
The first gate is the one that we describe as the one that culturally we are acknowledged for, which is when we lose someone or something that we love. Right now in this culture, we've had a wash of foreclosures, people losing their homes, people losing the places where they have lived maybe for years and years. But this is a great sorrow. This is a great loss for many people. Losing loved ones, I've been working with a number of people who've lost children lately, and almost that inconsolable sorrow that comes from that deep, deep rip in the soul, losing a child. And this gate acknowledges that by the sheer fact that we've chosen to love something, we have made on some level an agreement to enter into the rites of grief. Those two are hand in hand, as we talked about last week. The love is to know loss and to truly protect oneself from the fierce edge of sorrow. We have to close the heart down to love, which is, as Mary Oliver said, no life at all. So that's part of what happens at the first gate of grief, is that we recognize the fierce teaching that, as I say, everything we love, we will lose.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in my case, as you know from reading my book, that loss, you know, that acknowledgement happened at a very young age. I mean, when my best friend was murdered and I saw her parents and the way they looked, it was a rather shocking experience for me. And even at 11 years old, I mean, I remember sitting there and saying, oh, this is what happens when you love with all your heart. You have pain with all your heart. And seeing very clearly the other side, you know, the agreement that we make when we move into love, whether we're aware of it or not, on the conscious level. And I would just say that with children, I mean, in the case of me, you know, it was 1965. There were no adults in my life to accompany me through what I was experiencing. And so the conclusion I came to, the resolution in my heart was, you know, to never love anyone again as much as I loved her. And I repeated it many times as a mantra to protect myself. And I will have to say that my life's work has been to undo that conclusion I came to. And so my point here is that even with, you know, I've worked with many young children, even with young children, that awareness can happen at a very young age. And you know, just as with the grief rituals, you know, we all have within us everything we need to heal, except companions.
I think that is so absolutely right on. The instinct and the intuition of what to do with that sorrow is immediate. The context and the container is almost always absent.
Mm-hmm.
So this puts us in this tremendous bind of knowing what we need but not being able to accomplish the end.
Mm-hmm.
So when we gather again together, the permission that is granted by being in circle and given permission to talk about what's there, no matter how lingering this sorrow is, as I've shared in the book, stories of women, a nun that came to a class I was teaching and expressed a 65-year-old grief about the death of her father that had never been grieved before.
Mm.
So, you know, it doesn't matter how long the sorrow has been carried, once it's been given what it has been anticipating, the grief will flow.
Yes. So how about if we move into this discussion about illness? You know, in your writing you say, quote, "We lament the life we once knew and enjoyed, the one brimming with vitality and energy. We feel emptied and drained." So I think I'll just hand the floor over to you. Without a particular question, take us into this territory of grief and illness.
Well, it slowly became known to me by who was attending the grief workshops. I remember getting a call one time from a woman who had had cancer for many years, and someone had suggested she come to the grief ritual, and she said, "What would I get out of this?" And we talked for about 20 minutes, half an hour, and she finally says, "Okay, I'll come." And she's now been to 5 grief rituals.
Mm.
And part of what she had to lament and touch fully was the loss of her own life, the loss of her breast. She had to deal with the loss of friends who have died from other cancers, the loss of her own capacity to be in relationship, to express herself in work. This illness that she has been living with now for a long, long time is like a slow erosion, a slow, well, Jung called it a the defoliation process, a slow process by which our vital life begins to ebb and move away from our accessibility. And this is a great loss. And particularly, again, in a culture that prizes youth and vitality and, you know, the vigors of life. But we don't know how to respond when we begin to move into territories of weakness or limitation. Those territories hold much shame for us.
Right.
So
right.
We try to, again, you know, keep either hiding that reality from view, or we, you know, tend to disappear into our own private existence. Illness is something that culturally, again, we take a very almost militarized approach to it. We're going to defeat the illness.
Right.
And we rarely listen to the illness to see what part of the soul is actually being invited to express itself more fully through the illness.
You know, one of the things I often see is that people are afraid to go there because, you know, there's this belief among some people that we create our own reality. And I think to some degree, you know, we influence things that happen in our life, but who knows what the degrees are. And I think when people get sick, they're afraid to go into grief because they think they've created the illness by perhaps some kind of negative thinking, and that if they were to descend into some kind of grief, they would make the situation worse.
Mm.
Can you speak a little bit to this?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very punishing belief.
Yeah.
You know, it puts us in a position now that if I'm creating my own reality, then why am I creating this cancer or this diabetes or this depression? And what happens is that we end up pushing compassion out the door.
Right.
And in some ways, it doesn't matter what the cause. What matters is the response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm ill, there's a wonderful line from Mark Ian Barash. I don't know if you know his work, but...
I do.
Mark had a line once in an interview. He said, healing must address the questions that illness raises.
Mm.
So illness keeps bringing questions into the foreground of our lives. And rarely is the question, why, you know, what did you do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, what is being asked of you here? This kind of a new age psychological questioning or assumption about creating our own reality. You know, of course we contribute because it's our life. But it gets very dangerous and very, like I said, punitive when we take on this attitude that somehow I have brought this on myself. We then isolate ourselves like a single cell rather than a participant in a wide complex of environment and genetics and toxins and stress, and the whole life around us is part of also what our body swims in.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be, I mean, the ultimate response to any illness must be kindness, mercy, and compassion.
Mm.
And a generosity of spirit to oneself that we begin to ask for what we need. I mean, this is a big piece of illness, is that we are then confronted with limitation and almost pushed to the place where we have to ask for support. And that's a very hard thing, particularly for men in this culture.
Yeah, I have seen it. Yes. I have seen it with through the lens of, you know, because I have worked in the field of generosity for as long as I have, I've explored giving and receiving. And it feels to me like our work is to be able to absorb the full circle of giving and receiving. And when we place ourselves in the role of giving, there is a way in which even if we're not trying to create any kind of hierarchy or don't even see it that way, we kind of do. You know, we're benevolent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at the receiving end, it's just as important to be able to receive the help of others with grace, to ask, to even get to a place at times where we ask for help, and to see it in the lens of that full circle of giving and receiving, I think helps a bit to take, you know, any kind of fear of asking or shame associated with having to receive help from others away.
Absolutely. When we're doing our gatherings, I often talk about what I call the ecology of the sacred. And in a functioning ecology, there is this call and response between need and gift.
Mm-hmm.
And when I silence my need, I simultaneously deprive someone else from the opportunity of being spiritually employed.
Right.
In other words, their gift goes unused.
Right.
And that's part of our depression, too, in this culture, is we feel spiritually unemployed. We feel as if our gifts are rarely called upon, partly because the one who could ask has been shamed into silence.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we have started this interview so beautifully, Frances. We're going to have to take a break for a moment. Our listening audience, stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus drug discount card offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
What would you do if you knew that you could not fail? The Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile is a radio forum for some of the world's most influential people in the fields of health, wellness, and human potential. Dr. Pat brings together and introduces visionary scientists and futurists, environmentalists, educators, business leaders, inventors, filmmakers, authors, artists, mystics, and healers who inspire and support individual and collective growth and positive cultural shifts. This award-winning radio show empowers the listening community to be the change they want to see in the world. Tune in every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific for the Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile, radio to thrive by.
Adoption changes a family forever, for the adopters as well as the adoptees. There are many adjustments that need to be made, from lifestyle to financial, and the personal rewards are unlimited. Listen every week for Your Adoption Coach with Kelly Ellison. We will examine in detail such topics as international and domestic adoption. We will talk with adoption professionals and hear stories about real families adopting. If you've been thinking about adoption or recently began the process, you'll want to tune in to be inspired every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking to Frances Weller about his profound and beautiful book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. So we're going to cover the five gates of grief today, and we've just completed gate one. Gate two is called The Places That Have Not Known Love. You know, you write about, you know, it is the accumulated losses of a lifetime that slowly weigh us down. And these places that have not known love, it's almost like we don't even know we need to acknowledge them. And so perhaps you can talk to us about this and talk a little bit about how these even unacknowledged griefs weigh us down and what we can do about that.
You know, as a psychotherapist, this is probably the bulk and the majority of the work I do in my practice, is slowly beginning to identify those places that have been exiled, what I call the outcast brothers and sisters. Those parts of us that, for whatever reason, we learned did not fit into the family, into the schools, into our religious systems, workplace. We learn very quickly what part of us is too much, too needy, too exuberant. We are meant to sit still, be quiet, behave right, be appropriate. And so very quickly we learn that in order to be allowed inside the circle of welcome, I have to shape a self that approximates what I think they want from me, which means I have to end up cutting out huge portions of my being. For me, I had to let go of my anger, my sexuality, even my passions around laughter, joy. These did not fit in a very kind of, I don't want to call it oppressive family, but it was certainly not a very emotional family.
Mm-hmm.
There was not room for those type of things. So not only do they leave us, but we simultaneously begin to relate to them as wrong,
mm-hmm.
as bad. And so we not only push them out, we begin to hold contempt for them, hatred. I remember going to therapy in my early 30s for the express purpose of getting rid of these parts of me. I just figured if I could get rid of them, then I'd be fine. I would fit in finally. I actually saw these parts of me as the reason for my not belonging to the culture. Now, any time we lose the integrity of the psyche, any time we lose that feeling of welcome to all parts of us, that is a loss.
Right.
And the proper response to that loss should be grief, but we cannot grieve for something that we hold with contempt.
Right.
So this is that lingering, gathering weight of sorrow that follows us around our entire lifetime, is for these parts of our soul that we have banished, maintaining that banishment with shame and judgment and contempt, and the impossibility of reconciling with them until we soften and allow ourselves to grieve for the fact that I live for decades without these vital parts of my soul.
Mm-hmm. So this is really big work, and I guess I'm wondering a bit about the grief rituals and the preparation for that. We can go into therapy and have several sessions and say, this is the work I want to begin to work on. And a significant amount of that work can be done one-on-one. I'm positive of that. I've experienced it myself. Why don't you talk a bit about this particular gate in the field of the ritual that you do?
What happens in the ritual context is a level of shared revelation where people begin to talk about the parts of their own experience that have been banished, ashamed, lost, and there is a growing recognition that, you too.
Uh-huh.
You too have had that experience. You've lost that part of you.
Mm-hmm.
We begin to feel as if we all know this shedding process. And in a culture that does not know how to really welcome its people, we all kind of end up trying to shape-shift and create a self that, again, will be acceptable, but not vital. I often say I ended up performing Francis for 40 years, but not being Francis.
Mm.
And, you know, in the last 17, 18 years, I've become me, in part because of these, the welcoming of those exiled parts. Mm. So in the grief rituals, the writing practices and the group sharing oftentimes evokes the names of these parts of us. And the outcast brothers and sisters, the room gets very crowded, you know.
Right.
You know, all of these other parts that have been so silenced actually begin, we begin to invite their grief cry into the room. And it's very healing to sit side by side. I sat with a young man yesterday who had attended one of our rituals recently, and he was so blown away by how welcomed he felt into the room, because one of his outcast brothers is he's not enough.
Mm.
You know, and unless he's performing and unless he's really impressing people, he won't be enough.
Mm.
But he kept seeing in the eyes of the people in the room that you are welcome here.
Mm.
And his writings and his sharing kept talking about this inadequate brother who never measured up, you know, and who wouldn't be worthy of a place in the circle. But that's precisely, like I think we said this last week, that's precisely the part of us that actually brings us back into contact with.
Mm.
It is the outcast brothers and sisters. They are the ones who actually carry the capacity for redemption.
Mm. Such a beautiful phrase, too, you know, to call them brothers and sisters. It's
mm-hmm.
like, you know, they're family. We want to, we all want family. We want a healthy family. And we can participate in creating the healthy ecology, using your word here, within ourselves by
right.
bringing these brothers and sisters back into, I don't know.
Right.
Healthy family, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the psyche really wants that type of, I use the word wholeness cautiously because that's the, becomes an ideal then. But I think the psyche does not like the experience of such massive fragmentation.
Right.
And so that's why we're often visited with depressions or addictions or anxieties. The psyche wants us to actually try to bring them back into some type of relatedness right. with our central life.
Right. So in this segment, I want us to move into the next gate so that we have time through the whole interview to cover all five of them. So the next one is, the gate is called the Sorrows of the World. And you're right, this is the gate where we most directly experience the soul of the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, the soul of the world is a very ancient thought that everything possesses soul. Everything, in a sense, has an interiority to it, a subjectivity to it. Even stones, even what we call inanimate, meaning without soul. Everything, to the indigenous mind, to the indigenous soul, possesses that inner quality that if we attend to it carefully enough, we begin to be in conversation with it. So, the sorrows of the world, when we really pay attention, for instance, when we're driving up the coast and we come across a clear cut, it's not just my feeling sad for the clear cut. I'm actually receiving the sorrow of the place. It's actually upwelling through my body. I am receiving, this is my feeling, I am receiving the sorrow of the trees, of the animals, the birds, of the whole integrity of that place has been assaulted and violated.
Mm.
And that moves up and into my own recognition. I shared last week how when the Gulf oil spill happened and the sorrow of that place woke me up in the middle of the night frequently with tears.
Mm. Mm.
That's our recognition that we are a participant in the entire life flow of the planet. We are not separate. Mm-hmm. We are intimately intertwined with the beauty, but also the sorrow of the planet. Driving home at nighttime, my prayer all the way home is for no animal to step out in front of my car.
Mm.
I see this carnage every day of deer and raccoon, fox and owl on the side of the road. And if we pay attention again, the sorrows of the world touch us. And it needs to.
Right.
This is why we talked about soul activism. If we do not register the sorrows of the world, who will? And if we don't, who's going to respond?
Right. You know, you had written in one place in the book, we have all but forgotten the intimate connection between our breath and the generosity of the trees, the flowering plants and oceans offering us their gift of oxygen. And even when we can step into the knowledge of that, the feeling, the depth of what this, you know, exchange is, we allow ourselves then to more closely feel the losses as things like the oil spill happen or clear cutting of trees. I think it's just really important to acknowledge this exchange. It brings us more into right relationship with what is we take for granted, and we walk around as though it's we don't even acknowledge it.
I think that's true. I think we live in a very insulated, introspective world, and in a sense, we lose the world. And psychology has colluded with this a great deal, in a sense that we're continuously focusing on our feelings, on our dreams, and our images, which are very important. But somehow we've lost the soul of the world in the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of our most vital restoration projects, is to restore our relationship to the greater breathing earth.
Right. You know, when I went through my divorce, this was many years ago, it was early 40s, I was living in Tucson, Arizona at the time, and I just remember I kept feeling as though I needed a healing from the whole Mother Earth. And so I finally decided I was going to sleep outside for a period of time. And I, you know, in Arizona, they don't, you know, unless you want to irrigate, you don't really have grass. So my yard was, you know, there was a portion of it that was just dirt. And so I dug a small, not very deep, you know, just a few inches, but I dug a little hole the length of my body. And every night I would go out and I laid down cotton sheets and a down comforter, all natural. I just wanted all natural fibers. And I would lay down to sleep and say a little prayer that, you know, to the creepy crawlies, I'm here just, please don't hurt me. I'm here for just a time, but this is what I need. And you know, sleeping outside every night. I did it for about 3 months. And some really important things happened. I, you know, first of all, just watching, as I'd wake through the night, watching the movement of the moon, I could really feel my place on Earth and in nature and on Earth. And then the other thing that happened was I'd wake up every morning. You know, there was an affair. My husband had an affair. And so I'd wake up every morning with at least for a short period of time, I felt the connection of the three of us, the some kind of bigger thing we were playing out with one another. And I could say a prayer that we all healed in this process. I couldn't hold it all day long, but I felt it genuinely and honestly, and took a time of ritual and prayer each morning to acknowledge that and my connection to the earth. It was such a powerful experience for me.
It was a beautiful ritual.
It was.
Exactly. I mean, it goes way beyond trying to figure it out. Now, this is what sometimes is called the language older than words.
Mm-hmm.
We do something that, to the mind, it makes maybe no sense, but to the soul. You did a process there that spoke deeply to that, reconnecting to the larger belonging.
Right.
The two primary sins in this culture are amnesia and anesthesia. We forget and we go numb.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've chosen to do in that ritual process is to remember and to feel and to reconnect. And so I think you help to restore some more primary or primal relatedness that we oftentimes transpose onto our partners. You know, be everything for me. Be the village for me. Be the earth for me.
Right.
And that weight can be so oppressive at times.
Mm-hmm.
But you restored it. I think that's a beautiful ritual.
Yeah, it was. It was a powerful time for me. Well, we have to take one more break here. And so to our listening audience, stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Frances Weller as we explore gates 4 and 5 of grief.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
Why do most women who are actively dating have to know, what will the future hold? While for many types of guys, it just means, what's going to happen tonight? The Dating Revolution is a new kind of show about dating. It's not necessarily about finding Mr. Right. It's more about staying in control of what you want and having fun while dating. Your host, Heather Jones, is a casual dating expert and will provide the tips and tricks both women and men need to navigate the ever-changing world of dating. Tune in Wednesdays at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
Ask Theo Live is talk radio like you've never heard before. Following her near-death experience, world-renowned author and spiritual medium Sheila Gillette became the direct voice channel for Theo, a consortium of 12 archangels. Through this unique channel, Sheila and her co-host Marcus Gillette present you with an opportunity to speak directly with Theo live on air on any topic you wish to discuss, including receiving authentic messages from deceased loved ones and angelic guides. Get the answer you need by tuning in to Ask Theo Live Talk Radio. Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Seventh Wave Network.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking with Frances Weller, author of Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. Frances, the fourth gate is called What We Expected and Did Not Receive. You write, we were meant to drop below the surface of things and to experience the depths of life in the same way that our deep time ancestors knew. Let's begin here. Can you tell us about this gate?
I remember R.D. Lang, the wild psychiatrist, once saying, we're all born as Stone Age children. And this is true. We arrive here expecting and anticipating the same type of entry that our deep time ancestors did. In other words, our entire biology, our entire psychology, I would say even our entire spirituality, was shaped in this long process of evolving as a species for, you know, several million years, particularly concentrated now in the last 150 to 250,000 years. What evolved out of that time was a set of expectations that shaped us into successful human beings, healthy human beings. So when we arrived here, we expected to open our eyes and have, you know, 30 or 40 pairs of eyes looking back at us. We expected to wake up in the morning, to step out of our little house, our hut, our wherever we slept, maybe it was out in the open, to be received by another 40 pairs of eyes saying, "What did you dream last night, Mariana?" And it's time for us to get food together, and it's time for us to, you know, and tonight we're going to be doing that celebration ritual for the food that we received today, and someone so-and-so lost a, you know, a daughter, and so we're going to do a grief ritual tonight, in the evening when the sun goes down, and expected to sit around the fire at night and listen to stories being told about the great myths, the great stories, the great legends. Expected to sit under the stars every night and share food and laughter. I can tell you the deepest envy I've ever felt in my life was when I was visiting Africa, and every night at dusk, people would come and the commons would swell with people. And every night they shared food and millet beer and stories and laughter and arguments, and it was so alive, and the children would be running around and playing, and they would lay down on the ground finally and fall asleep. And I didn't know which child belonged to whom until they scooped them up and took them back. But every night, this was the gathering. This is what we expected. Wow. Now, we go home to our single-family houses. Sometimes we go home to our own home by ourselves. This is also culturally when we have happy hour. We give half-price drinks, and we think that's a kind of a consolation prize. Mm-hmm. The not having this rich and vital and vibrant communal experience every night. This is what we expected. And for most of us, none of this evolved. None of this appeared. And the worst part about this gate is that we often blame ourselves for the circumstance. What did I do wrong that this expectation is not? Mm-hmm. And it often lingers in internally as an experience of emptiness. Mm-hmm. And so many of the patients I see in my practice talk about, "I feel empty." Mm-hmm. And that emptiness is again interpreted as some lack personally, some flaw, some failure on my part. But when I begin talking about that with them and sharing that this is not so much an emptiness as it is an absence.
Right.
What you expected did not materialize. This is not some personal defect. And so we need to address this emptiness by offering you what it is you actually require. And once we begin to try to even partially provide the containment for intimacy, belonging, participation, that emptiness begins to fade. I hope this is making sense. It's a very complex gate to talk about.
Partly
because, even as you say, we don't even know to expect it. We don't even know that it's missing.
Right.
You ask anybody if they feel that there's something absent in their life, and almost everybody will say, absolutely.
Right. And the trick is, you know, even I imagine, you know, even when you're in, not even I imagine, I know, even when you're in an intact kind of family where you're all together, creating in this time in history, creating an environment where you can create a mini sense of that in the evening must be incredibly rare. I don't hear any families doing this.
I think it's
perhaps at dinner, but that's about it.
I think it's incredibly rare. Well, the original matrix of who we are was we evolve and we come out of mystery. This is my definition of identity. We emerge out of mystery into this body. The body, in a healthy functioning cosmos, the body emerges into a family. The family is held within a living community. In the living community takes the shape of clan life, which is a place of spiritual employment. And in totality, we are embedded in the cosmos. That's who I am. I am this wild, arcing, shape-shifting, participating element in this that takes me from mystery all the way back to cosmos. So I am part of the night sky. I'm part of the whole dreaming process. But we've lost cosmos. We've lost clan life. Community has kind of become this rhetoric that we talk a lot about but rarely know. Families, as you've just said, are very isolated and often fragmented. And usually I'm just left with this body. And we wonder why we feel so alone. Mm-hmm. And we wonder why we feel so kind of fragmented and disconnected from the larger dream. Well, that's in great part why it is so.
Right. I was a speaker at a talking circle in your neck of the woods in Sonoma Wednesday night. There's a woman named Carol Pecorini who has a beautiful organization called Big Ideas, Rich Conversations with Women. And it was a circle of about 15 women. And I talked about your book, in fact, and talked about mine being there for someone in grief. And the whole journey of, you know, experiencing our grief so that we can have the fullness of, in my view, as I described in the last show, generosity and love, or, you know, the fullness of life at the other end of the spectrum. And when the evening was over, Carol said, I don't know why we don't do this every night. This is the richest experience we can have.
There you go. Precisely. This is what we expected, you know, and even when we're coming to the end of our weekends together for the grief rituals, there's this already, you can feel the melancholy slipping into the room right beside the joy. And this melancholy is the awareness that for a while we were living in what I call primary satisfactions. We were living in the things that the soul expected and now being granted. And so for a while we felt everything is right. We wake up, we're there together, we're sharing breakfast together, we're talking about our dreams, and we're singing together, and we're sharing poetry and stories, and our lives are becoming known to one another, and we're in deep ritual together. And for a while, we're living inside of primary satisfactions. But as we're coming to the end of Sunday, the anticipation of leaving begins to come into the room, and you can feel it. You can feel the melancholy coming in. And I tell the people there that now you've had the taste of being inside of the village. You now have a taste of what that's like. And this melancholy is your homing beacon. This melancholy is the taste on your tongue that tells you and reminds you, I have tasted this. This is what I yearn for. This is what I must create in my world. So we typically want to get away again from melancholy and grief, but what if that melancholy is your homing beacon? What if it's your reminder that this is what my soul yearns for and what I must bring back more deeply into my world?
What a beautiful way to frame that. That is just perfect. Thank you. So I want us to talk a bit about the fifth gate, which is such an interesting one to me. It's ancestral grief. It's the grief we carry in our bodies from sorrows experienced by our ancestors. I want to read a little, it's a paragraph actually, if you don't mind, of that you wrote. From your book in this segment. Sometimes I will be working with someone who carries a sadness that is hard to identify, but it is there nonetheless. After exploring many possible sources for this sorrow, I often ask if there was something in the family history that might be lingering in their body. Following some reflection, there is often a memory of some loss, some wounding that occurred to a grandparent, or some experience of abandonment that resides in the psychic history of the lineage. Sometimes it centers on the great tear in the psychic foundations of a family following the suicide of a child, husband, wife, brother, sister. I've worked with a number of individuals who carry the inheritance of this wound in the ancestral lineage. In this place, grief and shame become intermingled, making it difficult to sort through the confusing emotions that accompany the story. These individuals often feel haunted by the fear that this may also become their destiny. Unquote. I know that as we talk about ancestral
grief, we're not just talking about a situation of a suicide that happened somewhere in our family's past. So we will talk about the full piece of ancestral grief. But perhaps we can enter into this one, because I think we underestimate this, the way in which the trail of that impacts those of us in a family.
I think we absolutely do. I mean, I see that all the time in my practice. Particular style or particular trait that somebody is carrying, whether it's addiction. I mean, we can talk about addiction as an ancestral lineage, because now we talk about the genetics of addiction. It's beyond the genetics of it. There's also the whole inheritance that is soulful, that is emotional, that creates an entire pattern of life that is not solely the person's individual life. It is the larger wrapping, the larger enclosure that comes from this ancestral lineage. And until we begin to unpack all that, it's very hard to work with, because it's not just some personal piece of their story they're working with. We oftentimes will end up doing little rituals to help them untangle this knot that began in some other generation, to help them really free themselves up so that their life can begin to become their own life and not simply the continuation of a wounding that began in some other time. And now we're pretty clear that from physics that time is very bendable. My sense is that the healing that we do right now moves both backward into that past generations and forward to the anticipated generations. We clear the trail and we also repair the trail by the work that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So some of the ancestral grief, going beyond just that part, is just the feeling that when our ancestors left, wherever they left from, they left probably a fairly intact community setting.
Mm-hmm.
They had language, they had songs, they had their own rituals and traditions, they had their food, they had probably 100, if not thousands of years of familiarity with place. And all of that is uprooted, literally,
mm-hmm.
when they come to this new country. And there is a lot, you know, that legacy of loss is also part of what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But hidden within that is a deeper grief that has to do with what happened when a lot of our ancestors arrived here on this continent, particularly those that came in the 1600s and 1700s.
Yeah, they lost their homes, they lost their culture, they had to blend. How do they keep their place? I can see that it was, I mean, even now when I see immigrants come, you know, we've given many grants at Bread for the Journey to programs that work with immigrants to help them acclimate to life here in the United States. So I've come to know a little bit about this process, and we're coming close to the end of the show, so
right.
We only have another minute. But it's such an important thing to acknowledge the ancestors, and I just thank you so much for bringing it up.
You're very welcome. I think it is a very vital topic, and hopefully people will begin to pay attention to this other aspect of our soulful life.
Right. So I really, as you know, I'm just in love with this book. And so to our listening audience, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World by Frances Weller. I highly recommend it. And Frances, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us for these two shows. You've really made it a beautiful experience for me and for our listening audience.
Thank you, Mara. I've enjoyed it thoroughly and hope our paths cross many times.
I hope so, too.
So, as you know, this show is hosted by Bread for the Journey. If you want to know more about our organization, go to breadforthejourney.org. And I'll close, as I do every show, with this. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.